not? Or are you too proud? God help me. The Nabonae are with us already. Do you understand? I have just seen Baron de Vercellis, an hour gone. But now the High King's daughter is out needlessly wandering the land somewhere, with all of her father's troops about to go into the field, and his spies swarming everywhere like maggot flies. Joshua waved his arms in frustration, then slumped into his chair, long legs stretched before him. It is too much for me, Iskrenor, he said wearily. And you wonder why I do not declare myself a rival for Elia's throne. I cannot even keep a young girl safely under my roof. Iskrenor smiled dolefully. Her father didn't have much luck in keeping her either, as I recall. Still, the prince brought his hand up to knead his brow. Osiris, my very head throbs with it all. Now, Joshua, the duke said, casting a look at the others to warn them to keep silence. All is not lost. We must simply put a troop of good men out to beat the bushes for Miriamel and this monk, this Cedric or whatever. Cadrach, said Joshua tonelessly. Yes, then, Cadrach. Well, a young girl and a holy friar cannot move that quickly afoot. We shall simply put some men to horse and get after them. Unless the Lady Vosheva here has hidden horses for them as well, Joshua said sourly. He sat up. You haven't, have you? Vosheva could not meet his gaze. Merciful Aiden, Joshua swore. That is the final trick. I shall send you back to your barbarian father in a sack, you wildcat.
Prince Joshua?
It was the harper. When he got no response, he cleared his throat and tried again. My prince? What? Joshua said irritably. Yes, you may go. I will have words with you later. Go.
No, sir. That is, did you say the monk's name was Cadrach?
Yes, so the gate captain said. He spoke with a man a bit wide. Do you know him or know his haunts?
Well, no, Prince Joshua, but I think the boy Simon met him. He told me much of his adventures, and the name sounds quite familiar.
Oh, sir, if it is him,
the princess may be in some danger.
What do you mean? Joshua leaned forward.
The Cadrach Simon told me of was a rogue and a cutpurser.
That one also went in the guise of a monk, but he was no Aidenite man, that's sure.
It cannot be, Vosheva said.
The coal around her eyes had run onto her cheeks.
I have met this man, and he quoted me from the Book of Aiden. He is a good, kind man, Brother Cadrach.
Even a demon can quote the book, Iskrenor said, shaking his head sorrowfully.
The prince had sprung to his feet and was moving to the door. We must put men out at once, Iskrenor, he said, then stopped and turned back, taking Vosheva by the arm. Come, lady, he said brusquely. You will not undo your damage, but you may at least come along and tell us all you know, where you have hid the horses and all such. He pulled her to her feet.
But I cannot go out, she said, shocked. Look, I have been weeping. My face, it is terrible.
For the hurt you have done to me, and maybe to my foolish niece as well, it is a small enough penalty. Come!
He hurried her before him out of the chamber, Iskrenor following. Their arguing voices echoed down the stone corridor. Sangfugl, left behind, looked sorrowfully down at his lute. There was a long crack twisting the length of its curved ashwood back, and one of the strings hung loose in a useless curl.
Scant music, but sour, will be made tonight, he said.
It was still an hour before dawn when Luth came to her bedside. She had not been able to sleep all night, stretched tight inside with worry for him. But as he bent over to touch her arm, she pretended sleep, wanting to spare him the only thing left from which she could spare him, the knowledge of her own great fear.
Maegwin, he said softly.
Her eyes shut fast, she fought the urge to reach up and hug him tight. Full armored but for his helmet, as she knew from the sound of his walk and the scent of polishing oil, he might have trouble straightening up again if she pulled him down so close. Even the parting she could stand,
bitter though it was. The thought of him showing his weariness and his age this night of all nights, she could not.
"Is that you, father?" she said at last.
"It is."
"And are you going now?"
"I must. The sun will be up soon, and we hope to reach the edge of the Coombe Wood by mid-morning."
She sat up. The fire had burned out, and even with her eyes open she could not see much. Faintly, through the walls, she could hear the sound of her stepmother, Inawen, sobbing. Maegwin felt a twinge of anger at such a display made of grief.
"Bring the ox shield over your father," she said, reaching out a blind hand to find his battered face. "I wish I was a son to fight at your side."
She felt his lips curl beneath her fingers.
"Ah, Maegwin, you were ever a fierce one. Have you not duty enough here? It will not be easy being mistress of the Teig while I am gone."
"You forget your wife?"
Luth smiled again in the dark.
"I do not. You are strong, Maegwin, stronger than she. You must lend her some of your strength."
"She usually gets what she wants."
The king's voice was gentle, but he caught her wrist in a firm hand.
"Don't, daughter. Along with Gwythyn, you are the three I love most in all the world. Help her."
Maegwin hated to cry. She pulled her hand from her father's grasp and rubbed her eyes fiercely.
"I will," she said. "Forgive me."
"No forgiveness necessary," he answered,
then took her hand once more and squeezed.
"Farewell, daughter, until I come back again. There are cruel ravens in our field, and we have work to do chasing them out again."
She was up and out of bed then, and threw her arms around him. A moment later the door opened and closed, and she heard his steps going slowly up the hall, the clink of spurs like sad music. Later, when she cried, it was with the blankets over her head so that no one would hear. Chapter 36. Fresh Wounds and Old Scars. The horses were more than a little afraid of Kantaka, so Binnebik rode the great grey wolf well ahead of Simon and the others, carrying a hooded lamp to show the way in the blanketing darkness. As the tiny caravan made its way along the skirt of the hills, the shuddering light bobbed before them like a corpse candle. The moon cowered within its nest of clouds, and their progress was slow and cautious. Between the gentle jogging rhythm of the horse beneath him and the feel of its warm, broad back, Simon nearly fell asleep several times, only to be startled awake by thin, scrabbling fingers at his face, the branches of close-hovering trees. There was little talk. From time to time, one of the men whispered a word of encouragement to his mount, or Binnebik called back softly to warn of some upcoming obstacle. But for those sounds and the muffled percussion of hoofbeats, they might have been a grey pilgrimage of lost souls. When the moonlight finally began to seep through a rent in the cloud ceiling, not long before dawn, they stopped to make camp. Vaporous breath caught the moon's glow, making it seem they exhaled silver-blue clouds as they tied up their mounts and the two pack horses. They lit no fire. Ethelbern took first watch. The others, wrapped in their heavy cloaks, curled up on the damp ground to snatch what sleep they could. Simon awoke to a morning sky like thin gruel, a nose and ears that seemed to have magically turned to ice in the night. As he crouched by the small fire, chewing the bread and hard cheese Binnebik had doled out, Sludig sat down beside him. The young Rimmersman's cheeks were polished red by the brisk wind.
"This is like our early spring weather back in my home,"
he grinned, skewering a heel of bread on the long blade of his knife and holding it over the flame.
"It makes a man of you quick, you will see."
"I hope there are other ways of becoming a man besides freezing to death," Simon grunted, rubbing his hands together.
"You can kill a bear with a spear," Sludig said. "We do that also."
Simon could not tell whether he was joking. Binnebik, who had just sent Kantaka off to hunt, came over and sat down cross-legged.
"Well, the two of you, are you ready to be at hard riding today?"
he said. Simon did not respond, since his mouth was full of bread. When a moment later Slewdig had not answered either, Simon looked up. The Rimmer's man was staring straight into the fire, his mouth in a set, straight line. The silence was uncomfortable. Simon swallowed. "I suppose so, Binnabik," he said quickly. "Do we have far to go?" Binnabik smiled blithely, as though the Rimmer's man's silence were perfectly natural.
"We will be going as far as we shall wish. Today it seems good to ride long, since the skies are clear. Sooner than we are wishing, we may be found by rain and snow."
"Do we know where we're headed?"
"In part, friend Simon."
Binnabik took a length of twig from the outskirts of the fire pit and began to scratch lines in the moist earth.
"Here is standing Naglimund," he said, drawing a rough circle.
He then made a line of scallop shape starting at the circle's right flank and extending up for some distance.
"That the Wealdhelm. This cross is being us here."
He made a mark not far past the circle. Then in quick succession, he drew a large oval near the far end of the mountains, a few smaller circles scattered around its rim, and what seemed to be another line of hills out beyond.
"So then," he said, hunkering down close over his furrowed patch of ground, "soon it is we shall be approaching this lake."
He indicated the large elliptical shape,
"which is called Drosshall."
Slewdig, who seemingly against his will had leaned over to look, straightened up.
"Drosulven, the lake of Droshammer."
He frowned and tilted forward once more, making a dot with his finger along the lake's western rim.
"There is Vestvenby, the thaneland of that traitor Storfot. I would like very much to pass through there by night."
He wiped the breadcrumbs from the blade of his dagger and held it up to catch the weak firelight.
"We will not, however, be going to there," Binnabik said sternly. "And for you, revenge must wait. We are passing to the other side, past Hulnir to Heathstad, near where is the Abbey of St. Skendi, then most likely up across the plain of the north toward the mountains. No stopping before for cutting off throats."
He pushed his stick up beyond the lake, toward the row of rounded shapes.
"That is because you trolls do not understand honor," Slewdig said bitterly, staring at Binnabik from beneath his thick blonde eyebrows.
"Slewdig," Simon said pleadingly,
but Binnabik did not respond to the man's baiting.
"We are having a task to perform,"
the troll responded calmly.
"Iskrenor, your duke, wishes it, and his will is not served with faithfulness by creeping off at night times to slit the throat of Storfot. That is not a troll's lack of honor, Slewdig."
The Rimmer's man looked hard at him for a moment, then shook his head.
"You are right."
There was, to Simon's surprise, no sullenness remaining in his voice.
"I am angry, and my words were poorly chosen."
He got up and walked away toward where Grimrik and Hasten stood reburdening the horses. As he went, he flexed his supple, muscular shoulders, as though to loosen knots. Simon and the troll stared after him for a moment.
"He apologized," Simon said.
"All Rimmer's men are not being that cold one, Einskaldir,"
his friend replied.
"But also, all trolls are not either being Binnabik."
It was a very long day's ride, up along the flank of the hills under the cover of the trees. When they finally stopped for their evening meal, Simon knew for certain the truth of Hasten's earlier warnings. Although his horse walked slowly and their march had been over mild terrain, his legs and crotch felt as though he had spent the day attached to some dreadful torture device. Hasten, not without a grin, kindly explained to him that after a night's stiffening, the worst would be yet to come. He then offered him as much of the wineskin as he cared to drink. When Simon eventually curled up that evening between the humped and mossy roots of a nearly leafless oak tree, he was feeling a little better, although the wine made him think he heard voices singing strange songs on the wind. When he woke up in the morning, it was to discover that not only was everything Hasten had claimed true tenfold, but snow was swirling down as well, covering Wealdhelm hills and travellers alike in a cold, clinging white coverlet. Even shivering in the weak Yuven daylight, he could still hear the wind voices. What they were saying was clear. They mocked calendars and fleered at travellers who thought they could walk with impunity into winter's new kingdom. The Princess Miriamele stared with horror at the scene spread before her. What had been since the beginning of the morning's ride, a riot of colours and black smoke on the horizon, now lay clear as she and Cadrach stood on the hillside, overlooking the Inniscrick. It was a tapestry of death, woven in flesh and metal and shredded earth.
"Merciful Alicia," she gasped, reining in her shying horse. "What has happened here? Is this my father's work?"
The small round man squinted, mouth working for a moment in what the princess took for silent prayer.
"Most of the dead are Ernestiri, my lady," he said at last, "and I'm guessing the others are Rimmer's men from the look of them."
He frowned on the scene below as a group of startled ravens all leaped up at once, like a clutch of flies, circled, then settled again.
"It appears the battle, or the retreating part of it, has moved away west."
Miriamele found her eyes filling with frightened tears, and reached up a fist to scour them away.
"The survivors must be falling back to Hernisadag, to the Take. Why has this happened? Has everyone gone mad?"
"Everyone was mad already, my lady,"
Cadrach said with a strange, sorrowful smile.
"It is merely that the times have brought it out in them."
They had ridden swiftly for the first day and a half, pushing the Lady Vorsheva's horses to their gasping limit, until they reached and crossed the Green Wade River at its upper fork, some 25 leagues southwest of Naglamund. They then slowed their pace, giving the horses a chance to rest in case they should again need to ride in haste. Miriamele rode well in the manly style, which was appropriate to the garment she wore, the breeches and jerkin, in which she had disguised herself in her escape from the hayholt. Her shorn hair was again black-dyed, although little of it showed beneath the travelling hood, worn as much against the cold as against discovery. Brother Cadrach, riding beside her in his travel-stained grey habit, was no more likely than she to attract notice. In any case, there were few other travellers on the river road in such discouraging weather, and in the midst of such perilous times. The princess had begun to feel quite confident that their escape was safely effected. Since the middle of the day before, they had ridden along the dike road above the wide, swollen river, with the braying of distant trumpets in their ears, shrill, brazen voices that outstripped even the moan of the rain-laden wind. At first it was frightening, raising the spectre of some vengeful troop of her uncle's or her father's at their heels. But soon it became apparent that she and Cadrach were approaching the source of the clamour rather than the reverse. Then, this morning, they had seen the first signature of battle, lonely trails of black smoke inking the now calm sky.
"Isn't there anything we can do?"
Miriamele asked, dismounted and standing beside her gently blowing horse. But for the birds, the scene below them was as motionless as if carved in grey and red stone.
"And what might we do, my lady?" Cadrach asked, still a saddle. He took a swig from his wineskin.
"I don't know. You're a priest. Mustn't you say a mansa for their souls?"
"For whose souls, princess? Those of my pagan countrymen? Or those of the good Aidenites from Rimmersgard, who have come down to pee this call on them?"
His bitter words seemed to hang like smoke. Miriamele turned to stare at the little man, whose eyes now seemed quite unlike those of the jocular companion of the last few days. When he told stories or sang his Hernestiri riding and drinking songs, he fairly glittered with cheer. Now he looked like a man savoring the doubtful victory of a dire prophecy fulfilled.
"All Hernestiri are not pagans," she said, angry with his strange mood.
You yourself are an Aedonite monk. Should I go down then and ask who is pagan and who is not?
He waved a plump hand at the unmoving spectacle of carnage.
No, my lady, the only work still to be done here will be done by scavengers.
He prodded his horse with his heels and rode ahead a short distance. Merimel stood and stared, pressing her cheek against the horse's neck.
Surely no religious man could stand by and see such a scene unmoved, she called after him. Even that red monster Priorates.
Cadrach hunched at the mention of the king's counselor, as if struck in the back, then rode a few more paces, before stopping to sit for a while in silence.
Come, lady, he said at last over his shoulder. We must get down from this hillside where we are in such plain view. Not all scavengers are feathered, and some go on two legs.
Dry-eyed now, the princess shrugged wordlessly and clambered back into the saddle, following the monk down the forested slope that ran beside the blooded Innescrick. As he slept that night in their camp on the hillside, above the flat, white, treeless expanse of Drawshole Lake, Simon dreamed again of the wheel. Once more he found himself snagged helplessly, tossed about like a child's doll of rags, lifted aloft on the wheel's vast rim. Cold winds buffeted him, and shards of ice scored his face as he was drawn up into freezing blackness. At the summit of the ponderous revolution, wind ripped and bleeding, he saw a gleam in the darkness, a luminous vertical stripe that reached from the impenetrable blackness above to the equally murky depths below. It was a white tree, whose broad trunk and thin branches glowed as though stuffed with stars. He tried to pull himself free from the wheel's grip, to leap out toward the beckoning whiteness, but it seemed he was held fast. With one great final effort, he tore loose and jumped. He plunged downward through a universe of glowing leaves, as though he flew among the lamps of stars. He cried out for Blessed Osiris to save him, for God's help, but no hands caught at him as he plummeted through the cold firmament. Hölnir, at the slowly freezing lake's eastern rim, was a town empty of even ghosts. Half buried beneath the drifting snows, its houses unroofed by wind and hail, it lay like the carcass of a starved elk beneath dark, indifferent skies.
Have Skarli and his ravens so soon wrung the life from all the Northland? Sludig asked, his eyes wide. As like they all fled the late frost, Grimrik said, pulling his cloak tight beneath his narrow chin. Too cold here, too far away from the few roads open.
It is probable Hesed will be the same, Binnabik said, urging Kantaka back up the slope. Good it is that we had no plan to find supplies on our way.
Here at the lake's far end, the hills began to fade, and a great arm of the northern Aldeota reached out to cloak their last low slopes. It was different than the southern part of the forest Simon had seen, and not only because of the snow that now carpeted the forest floor, stealing away the very sound of their passage. Here the trees were straight and tall, dark green pines and spruce that stood like pillars beneath their white mantles, separating wide, shadowy corridors. The riders moved as through pale catacombs, snow sifting down from above, like the ash of ages.
There is someone there, Brother Cadrach, Miriamel hissed. She pointed. There! Can't you see the gleam? It's metal.
Cadrach lowered the wineskin and stared. His mouth was stained purplish red at the corners. He scowled and squinted as if to satisfy a whim of hers. A moment later, the frown deepened.
By the good God, you are right, princess, he whispered, drawing back on his reins. There is something there, sure enough.
He handed the traces to her and slipped down onto the thick green grass. Then, with a gestured admonition to silence, he crept forward. Using a broad tree trunk to shield his almost equally stout form, he moved to within 100 paces of the glimmering object, craning his neck around to peer at it like a child playing hide-and-seek. After a moment he turned back and beckoned. Miriamele rode forward, bringing Cadrach's horse beside her own. It was a man who lay half-propped against the sprawling base of an oak tree, clad in armor that still shone in a few spots, despite the fearful battering it had taken. Lying in the grass at his side was the hilt of a shattered sword, and a broken pole and green pennant, which bore the emblazoned white stag of Hernestir.
"Elysia, Mother of God," Miriamele said, as she hurried forward. "Is he still alive?"
Cadrach quickly tied the horses up to one of the oak's arching roots, and then moved to her side.
"It doesn't look likely."
"But he is," the princess said. "Listen, he is breathing."
The monk kneeled down to look at the man, whose breath indeed sounded haltingly within the chamber of his half-open helmet. Cadrach tilted up the mask beneath the winged crest to expose a moustached face almost hidden by runnels of dried blood.
"Hound of heaven," Cadrach sighed. "It is Ath Preas, the Count of Cruvni."
"You know him?"
Miriamele said, searching in her saddlebag for the water skin. She found it and moistened a piece of cloth.
"Know of him? Really?"
Cadrach said, and gestured at the two birds stitched on the knight's tattered surcoat.
"He's the liege lord of Cruvni, near Mad Mullach, he is. His sign is the twin meadowlarks."
Miriamele dabbed at Athpreya's face, while the monk gingerly explored the blooded rents in his armor. The knight's eyes fluttered.
"He's awakening," the princess said, breathing in sharply. "Cadrach, I think he will live."
"Not long, lady," the small man said quietly. "There is a wound here in his belly as wide as my hand. Let me give him the last word, since he can die in peace."
The count groaned, and a little blood ran over the rim of his lip. Miriamele tenderly wiped it from his chin. His eyes trembled open.
"Igundain slueth, Marconrin," the knight muttered in Hernestiri.
He coughed weakly, and more blood bubbled onto his lips.
"There's a good lad. Did they take the stag?"
"What does he mean?"
Miriamele whispered. Cadrach pointed to the torn banner on the grass beneath the count's arm.
"You rescued it, Count Athpreas," she said,
holding her face close to his.
"It's safe. What happened?"
"Skali's raven warriors. They were everywhere."
A long cough, and the knight's eyes opened wider.
"Ah, my brave boys. Dead. All dead. Hacked up like.
Athpreas gave a painful, dry sob. His eyes stared up at the sky, moving slowly as if tracing the movement of clouds.
"And where is the king?" he said at last. "Where is our brave old king? The Goyrach northerners were all around him. Brynioch Rotham, Brynioch Nafirth, Upstrutton."
"The king?" Miriamele whispered. "He must mean Luth."
The count's eyes suddenly lit on Cadrach, and for a moment were kindled as though by an inner spark.
"Padraig,"
he said, and lifted a shaking, bloodied hand to lay it on the monk's wrist. Cadrach flinched, and made as though to draw away, but his eyes seemed caught, lit by a strange gleam.
"Is it you, Padraig, Vir? Have you come back?"
The knight stiffened then, and gave vent to a long, racking cough which brought the red flow up like an underground spring. A moment later his eyes rolled up beneath his dark lashes.
"Dead,"
Cadrach said after a moment, a harsh note in his voice.
"Osiri, save him, and God comfort his soul."
He made the sign of the tree over Athpreas' unmoving breast, and stood up.
"He called you Padraig,"
Miriamele said, staring abstractedly at the cloth she held, now entirely crimson.
"He mistook me," the monk said, "a dying man looking for an old friend. Come, we have no shovels for digging a grave. Let us at least find stones to cover him. I'm told he was a good man.
As Cadrach walked away across the clearing, Miriamel carefully pulled the armored gauntlet from Athpreya's hand, then wrapped it in the torn green banner.
"Please come and help me, my lady," Cadrach called. "We cannot afford to be spending much time here."
"I will come," she said,
slipping the bundle into her saddlebag.
"This much time we can afford."
Simon and his companions made their way slowly around the long circumference of the lake, along a peninsula of tall trees and drifting snow. On their left lay the frozen mirror of Draw's Hull. The white shoulders of the upper wheeled helm loomed on the right. The song of the wind was loud enough to drown all conversation, softer than a full shout. As Simon rode, watching Hasten's wide, dark back jounce along before him, it seemed they were all solitary islands in a cold sea, in constant sight of each other, but separated by untrafficked expanses. He found his thoughts turning inward, lulled by the monotonous pacing of his horse. Strangely, in his mind's inlooking eye, the Naglamund they had just left seemed as insubstantial as a distant memory of childhood. Even the faces of Miriamel and Joshua were hard to recapture, as though he tried to summon the features of strangers whose importance had not been discovered until long after they were gone. Instead, he found vivid memories of the Hayholt, of long summer evenings in the common's yard, itchy with mown grass and insects, or of breezy spring afternoons climbing on the walls, when the heady scent of the rose hedges in the courtyard pulled at him like warm hands. Remembering the slightly damp odor of the walls around his tiny cot, pushed into a corner in the servants' quarters, he felt himself a king in exile, as though he had lost a palace to some foreign usurper. As, in a way, he had. The others seemed just as enfolded in their own thoughts. But for Grimrick's whistling, a thin trill of music that only occasionally rose above the wind, but seemed nevertheless constant, the trip around Draw's Hull Lake was made in silence. Several times, when he could make her out through the fluttering snowflakes, he thought he saw Kantaka stop and tilt her head as though to listen. When they finally made camp that night, with the main body of the lake now lying behind them to the southwest, he asked Binnabik about it.
"Does she hear something, Binnabik? Is there something ahead of us?"
The troll shook his head, extending his now unmittened hands closer to the small fire.
"Perhaps, but things that are before us, even in such weather, Kantaka smells them. It is into the wind that we are walking. More likely it is she hears a sound from behind, or to either side."
Simon thought about that for a moment. Certainly nothing had followed them from Baron, Holnir, devoid even of birds.
"Someone is behind us," he said.
"I am doubting. Who? And for what reason?"
Nevertheless, Sludig, bringing up the rear of the column, had also noticed the wolf's seeming uneasiness. Although he was still not entirely comfortable with Binnabik, and certainly was not ready to trust Kantaka, he rolled his sleeping cloak at the far side of camp when he slept. He did not doubt the grey wolf's keen senses. As the others sat eating hard bread and dried venison, he had taken out his whetstone to sharpen his hand axes.
"Here between the Dirmuskog, the forest north of us, and Draw's Hull Ven," Sludig said, frowning. "It has always been wild country, even when Iskrimno or his father ruled in Elvrit's Harla, and winter knew its place. These days, who knows what walks the white waste, or the troll fells beyond?"
He scraped rhythmically.
"Trolls, for one thing," said Binnabik sardonically. "But I can be assuring you there is scant fear of troll folk descending upon us in the night for killing and plunder."
Sludig grinned sourly and continued sharpening his axe.
"The Rimmer's man speaks sense," Hasten said, giving Binnabik a displeased look. "And 'tis not trolls I'm fearing myself."
"Are we near to your country, Binnabik?" Simon asked. "To Yikanuk?"
"We will be approaching with more closeness when we reach the mountains. But the place of my birth is in actuality, I think, east of where it is we are heading.
You think?
Do not be forgetting, we are still not sure with exactness where we go. The Rhymer's Tree, a tree of rhymes? I know the mountain called Ormsheim, where it is supposed this Kolmund went, is standing somewhere to the north, between Rimmersgard and Jekanok. But a big mountain it is,
the troll shrugged.
Is the tree on it, before it, or somewhere else altogether? I cannot know at this time.
Simon and the others stared glumly into the fire. It was one thing to undertake a perilous mission for your sovereign. It was another thing to search blindly in the white wilderness. The flames hissed as they bit at the damp wood. Kantaka rose from where she stretched on the naked snow and cocked her head. She walked purposefully to the edge of the clearing they had chosen, in a grove of pines on the low hillside. After a suspenseful interval, she walked back and lay down again. No one said a word, but a moment of tension had passed, leaving their hearts a little lighter once more. When they had all finished eating, more logs were fed onto the blaze, which popped and steamed in cheerful spite of the flurrying snow. As Binnebik and Hasten talked quietly, and Simon used Ethelbairn's whetstone on his own sword, a thin melody rose up. Simon turned to see Grimrik whistling, lips pursed, eyes fixed on the wavering flames. When he looked up and saw Simon staring at him, the wiry Erkinlander gave him a snaggle-toothed smile.
"Put me to mind of something," he said. "An old winter song it was."
"What then?" Ethelbairn asked. "Sing it, man. No harm in quiet song."
"Yes, go ahead," Simon seconded.
Grimrik looked over to Hasten and the troll, as if fearing an objection from that quarter, but they were still enmeshed in their discussion.
"Well then," he said, "suppose there's no harm in't."
He cleared his throat and looked down, as if embarrassed by the sudden attention.
"It's just a song my old father would sing when we'd go out of a decanter afternoon to cut wood."
He cleared his throat.
"A winter song," he added.
Then cleared his throat again and sang, in a scratchy but not untuneful voice.
"Ice is a-growing in the thatch, and snow is upon the sill. Someone's a-knocking at the door out in the winter's chill. Sing ye hey-o-ho, and who can it be? Fire is a-burning in the grate, shadows is on the wall. Pretty hard as she answers up inside a latch-locked hall. Sing ye hey-o-ho, and who can it be? Comes in a voice from winter dark, open up your door. Let me in for to share your fire and to warm my hands before. Sing ye hey-o-ho, and who can it be? Ah, the chaste and cherry maid, she answers, tell me, sir, oh. Who can ye be who walks abroad when naught outside should stir, oh? Sing ye hey-o-ho, and who can it be? A holy man, the voice replies, who has not food nor shelter. The words all spoke so piteous, if she were ice, 'twould melt her. Sing ye hey-o-ho, and who can it be? The Nye will let you in, good father, old bones will soon be warm. A maid can trust a man, a god, that he will never harm. Sing ye hey-o-ho, and who can it be? Open the door, and who stand there? A man who's nothing holy. Old one eye with his cloak and staff, and his wide brim hat pulled lowly. I lied to get inside. Old one eye grins and dances. The frost's my home, but I love to roam, and a mead is worth the chances.
All you series, are you mad? Sludig leaped up, startling everybody. His eyes wide with horror, he made the sign of the tree broadly before him, as though to fend off a charging beast.
"Are you mad?"
he asked again, staring at the dumbfounded Grimrik. The Erkinlander looked around at his other companions, shrugging helplessly.
"What's wrong with this Rimmer's man, troll?" he asked.
Binnebik squinted up at Sludig, who was still standing.
"What is the wrongness, Sludig? We are none of us understanding."
The northerner looked around at the uncomprehending faces.
"Are you all without your senses?" he asked. "Do you not know of who you are singing?"
Old One-Eye? Grimrick said, eyebrow cocked in puzzlement. It's just a song, Northman. Learned it from my father.
That is Odin One-Eye you sing of, Odin Rimmer, the black old god of my people. We worshipped him in Rimmer's god when we were sunk in our heathen ignorance. Do not call up Odin Sky Father when you walk in his country, or he will come to your grief.
Odin the Rimmer?
Benebik said wonderingly.
If you don't believe in him anymore, Simon asked, why are you afraid to speak of him?
Sludig stared, his mouth still taut with worry. I did not say I did not believe in him. Aiden, forgive me. I said we Rimmer's men no longer worship him.
After a moment, he lowered himself back to the ground. I am sure you think me foolish.
Better that than we call down jealous old gods on ourselves. We are in his country now.
It's just a song, Grimrick said defensively. I wasn't calling down anything. It's just a bloody song.
Benebik, is that why we call it Odin's Day?
Simon began, then broke off when he saw the troll was not listening. Instead, the little man wore a broad, cheerful grin, as though he had just swallowed a draught of some pleasing liquor.
That is it, certainly,
the little man said, and turned to pale, stern-faced Sludig.
You have thought of it, my friend.
What are you talking about?
The blonde, bearded Northman asked with some irritation.
I do not understand you.
What we are looking for. The place where Colmund was going. The Rhymus tree. Except we were thinking rhyme like poetry. But you have now said it. Odin Rimmer. Odin the Rhymer. Rhyme meaning frost. It is a Rhymus tree we are searching for.
Sludig retained his blank look for a moment, then slowly nodded his head.
Blessed Elysia Troll, the Odin tree. Why did I not think of it? The Odin tree.
You know the place Benebik is talking about?
Simon was slowly catching on.
Of course. It is an old, old legend of ours. A tree entirely of ice. The old tales say that Odin made it grow so he could climb to the sky and make himself king over all the gods.
But what good is legend to us?
Simon heard Hasten ask. But even as the words came to his ears, he felt a strange, heavy chill folding around him like a blanket of sleet. The icy white tree. He saw it again. The white trunk stretching up into the darkness. The impenetrable white tower. A great looming pale stripe against the blackness. It stood squarely in the track of his life. And somehow he knew there was no path around it, no way around the slender white finger, beckoning, warning, waiting.
The white tree.
Because the legend tells where it is too, a voice said, echoing as if down a long corridor. Even if there is no such thing, we know that Sir Colmund must have gone where the legend points, the northern face of Urmsheim.
Sludig is correct,
someone said. Benebik said,
we are needing only to go where Colmund was going with Thorn. Nothing else is having importance.
The troll's voice seemed very far away.
I think I have to go to sleep, Simon said, his tongue thick.
He got up and stumbled away from the fire, practically unnoticed by the others, who were talking animatedly of riding distances and mountain travel. He curled up in his thick cloak and felt the snowy world revolve dizzyingly around him. He shut his eyes, and though he still felt every pitch and yaw, at the same time he began sliding heavily, helplessly down into dream-thick sleep. All the next day they continued along the forested bight of snow between the lake and the settling hills, hoping to make Haithstead at the lake's northeastern tip by late afternoon. If its inhabitants had not fled the harsh winter and headed west, the companions decided, Sludig could go down by himself and restock some of their stores. Even if it lay deserted, they could perhaps take shelter in an abandoned hall for the night and dry out their things before the long trip across the waste. Thus it was with some anticipation they travelled, making good time along the lake shore. Haithstead, a village of some 2 dozen long houses, stood on a promontory of land scarcely wider than the town itself. Seen from the hillside above, the village seemed to sprout from the frozen lake. The cheering effect of their first glimpse lasted only about halfway down the sloping road into the vale. It became increasingly obvious that although the buildings stood, they were no more than burned-out shells.
"Damn my eyes," Sluudic said angrily. "This is not just a village abandoned, troll. They were driven out."
"If they were lucky enough to get out at all," Hasten muttered.
"I think I must be agreeing with you, Sluudic," Pinnabic said. "Still, we must go and look there to see how recent this burning is."
As they rode down to the bottom of the glen, Simon stared at the scorched remains of Haithstead, and could not help remembering the calcined skeleton of St. Hodoran's Abbey.
"The priest at the Hayholt always used to say, 'Fire purifies,'" he thought. "If that's true, then why does fire, does burning frighten everyone? Well, by the Aiden, I suppose no one wants to be purified that thoroughly."
"Oh, no," Haston said. Simon almost ran into him as the big guardsman reined up. "Oh, the good God," he added.
Simon peered around him to see a line of dark shapes filing out of the trees near the village, moving slowly into the snowy road, not 100 ells before them, men on horseback. Simon counted them as they made their way out into the open, 7, 8, 9. They were all armored. The leader wore a black iron helm shaped like a hound's head, showing the profile of the snarling muzzle as he turned to give orders. The 9 started forward.
"That one, the dog-headed one,"
Sluudic pulled his axes out and pointed at the approaching men.
"He is the one who led the ambush on us at Hodoran's. He is the one I offer young Hove and the monks at the abbey."
"Never'll we take him," Haston said calmly. "They'll carve us up. 9 men to 6, and 2 of us a troll and boy."
Pinnabic said nothing, but calmly unscrewed his walking stick, which had been thrust beneath the cinch strap of Kantaka's saddle. As he reassembled it, a matter of instants only, he said,
"We must run!"
Sluudig was already spurring his horse forward, but Haston and Ethelben reached him within a couple of paces and caught at his elbows. The Rimmer's man, who had not even donned his helmet, tried to shake them off. He had a distant look in his blue eyes.
"God damn it, man," Haston said. "Come on! At least we've got chance in among the trees."
The leader of the approaching riders shouted something, and the others kicked their horses into a trot. White mist flurried up from their horses' hooves as though they ran on sea foam.
"Turn him!"
Haston shouted to Ethelben, grabbing the reins of Sludig's horse as he himself wheeled about. Ethelben gave a smart smack with his sword hilt to the flank of the Rimmer's man's mount, and they spun away from the oncoming riders, who were howling along at full gallop now behind them, waving axes and swords. Simon was trembling so that he feared he might fall from his saddle.
"Binnabik, where?"
he shouted, his voice cracking.
"The trees,"
Binnabik called back, as Kantaka jumped forward.
"Death it would be to climb back up the road. Right, Simon, and stay to me nearly."
Now the horses of his companions were rearing and kicking on all sides as they headed off the wide path, away from the blackened ruins of Haithstead. Simon managed to slide his bow from where it hung over his shoulder, then leaned his head down over his horse's neck and dug in the spurs. With a bone-jarring surge, they were suddenly leaping over the snow and into the ever-thickening forest. Simon saw Binnabik's small back and the bobbing grey of Kantaka's hindquarters, as the trees loomed up dizzyingly on all sides. Shouts echoed from behind, and he looked back to see his other 4 companions in a close knot, with the dark mass of their pursuers beyond, fanning out through the forest. He heard a sound like the tearing of parchment, and for a brief moment saw an arrow quivering in a tree trunk just before him. The muffled drum fire of hoofbeats was everywhere, filling his ears even as he clung for his life to the pitching saddle. A whistling black thread was suddenly drawn out and snapped before his face, and then another. The pursuers were outflanking them, loosing their arrows almost broadside. Simon heard himself scream something at the plunging shapes flashing along beyond the near trees, and several more of the hissing darts snapped past. Clinging to his pommel, he reached the hand that held the bow back to draw an arrow from his jouncing quiver. But when he brought it forward, he saw it flash pale against the horse's shoulder. It was the white arrow. What should he do? In a split instant that seemed much longer, he pushed it back over his shoulder into the quiver, pulling out another. A mocking voice somewhere in his head laughed to see him picking and choosing arrows at such a moment. He almost lost bow and arrow both as his horse lurched around a snow-spattered tree that seemed to leap up in their path. A moment later, he heard a shout of pain and the terrified, terrifying scream of a falling horse. He darted a look over his shoulder to see only three of his companions behind him, and farther behind every moment, a thrashing tangle of arms and kicking horse legs and roiling snow. The pursuers went over and around the downed rider, undeterred.
Who was it?
Was his brief, flickering thought.
Up the hill! The hill!
Binnebik shouted hoarsely from somewhere to Simon's right. He saw the flag of Kantaka's tail as the wolf leaped up an incline into heavier trees. A thick clot of pines that stood like uncaring sentinels as the shouting chaos slashed past them. Simon yanked hard on his right-hand rein, having no idea if the horse would pay him any heed at all. A moment later they canted to the side and bolted up the slope behind the bounding wolf. The other three companions rushed past him, pulling up their steaming horses within the sparse shelter of a crown of staff-straight trunks. Sludig still wore no helmet, and the thin one was surely Grimrik, but the other man, bulky and helmeted, had gone a short way up the slope. Before Simon could turn to see who it was, he heard a hoarse shout of triumph. The riders were upon them. After a frozen moment, he knocked his arrow and lifted the bow, but the whooping attackers were moving in and out among the trees so quickly that his shot flew harmlessly over the head of the nearest man and disappeared. Simon let fly a second arrow, and thought he saw it strike the leg of one of the armored riders. Somebody shouted in pain. Sludig, with an answering howl, spurred his white horse forward, pulling his helm down over his head. Two of the attackers peeled off from the pack and angled toward him. Simon saw him duck the sword swipe of the first, and turning, crash his axe blade into the man's ribs as he swept past, bright blood rilling from the gash in the man's armor. As he turned from the first man, the second nearly caught him. Sludig had time only to deflect the man's swing with his other axe, but still took a clanging blow to the helmet. Simon saw the Rimmer's man wobble and almost fall as the attacker wheeled around. Before they came together again, Simon heard an ear-piercing screech and pivoted to see another horse and rider stagger toward him. A trollless Kantaka, teeth clinging to the man's unarmored leg, scrabbling with her claws at the shrilling horse's side. Simon pulled his sword from the scabbard, but as the rider struck helplessly at the wolf, his reeling steed plunged into Simon's own mount. Simon's blade spiraled away, then he too was briefly without weight or tether. A long instant later, the air was thumped from him, as though by a giant's fist. He skidded to a face-down halt, a short way from where his horse struggled with the other, in a panicked, whinnying knot. Through a biting mask of snow, Simon saw Kantaka pull herself out from beneath the two horses and sprint away. The man, caught shrieking beneath, could not escape. Climbing painfully to his feet, spitting icy grit, Simon snatched at his bow and quiver lying nearby. He heard the sounds of combat move away up the hill and turned to follow on foot. Somebody laughed. Not 20 paces below him, seated astride a motionless grey horse, was the man in the black armor who wore the head of a ravening hound. The stark, pyramidal shape was blazoned in white on his black jerkin.
"There you are, boy," Dogface said, deep voice tolling inside his helmet. "I have been looking for you."
Simon turned and dug up the snowy hill, stumbling, sinking into the knee-high drifts. The man in black laughed happily and followed. Picking himself up yet again, tasting his own blood from his torn nose and lip, Simon stopped at last, backed against a leaning spruce. He grabbed at an arrow and let the quiver drop, then knocked it and pulled back the bowstring. The man in black stopped, still half a dozen ells below, tilting his helmeted head to one side as if imitating the hound he resembled.
"Now kill me, boy, if you can,"
he mocked.
Shoot!
He spurred his horse up the hill toward where Simon stood shivering. There was a hiss, and a sharp, fleshy slap. Suddenly the grey horse was rearing up, up, mane flinging, head thrown back, an arrow shuddering in its breast. The dog-faced rider was thrown down hard into the snow. He lay as if boneless, even as his twitching horse fell to its knees and rolled heavily onto him. Simon stared with fascination. A moment later he was staring with even more surprise at the bow he still held in his outstretched arm. The arrow had not left the string.
Heston,
he said, turning to look up the slope. Three figures stood there in a gap between the trees. They were none of them Heston. They were none of them men. They had bright, feline eyes, and their mouths were set in hard lines. The Scyther who had shot the arrow knocked another, and lowered it until its delicately quivering head came to a halt, pointed at Simon's eyes.
Tsi, imtsi, sut hoda ya,
he said, his small, newly formed smile as cold as marble.
Blood, as you say, for blood.
Chapter 37. Jiriki's Hunt. Simon stared helplessly at the black arrowhead, at the trio of thin faces. His jaw trembled.
Ski! Ski!
A voice cried.
Stop!
Two of the Scythi turned to look up the hill to their right, but the one coolly holding the bent bow never wavered.
Ski! Ras! Sedea!
The small figure shouted, and then leaping forward fell into a snow-churning roll to stop at last, in a flurry of gleaming powder a few paces from Simon. Binnabik got slowly to his knees, coated in snow as though he had been floured by a hurrying baker.
What?
Simon forced his numb lips to shape words, but the troll signalled him to silence with an urgent flutter of his squat fingers.
Shh! Slowly! Be putting down the bow you are holding!